Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Happy to have the Strangers environment reporter Sydney Brownstone here. Welcome back, Sydney.
Thanks, Bill.
Q13 Fox TV political analyst C.R. Douglas. Nice to see you again.
Good afternoon.
Let's begin here. Critics of a proposed new Seattle police station say the building would waste money rewarding a racist police force. Mayor Murray responded by delaying the project. On Monday, the Block the Bunker protesters came to this city council meeting.
Okay, would you like public comment?
We want public comment!
Okay, we hear you. We hear you loudly and clearly. Let me speak. You have to learn how to listen. We will have public comment.
Unless you're ready to speak to that,
okay.
We're not willing to listen.
So,
unacceptable.
You're giving me no choice but to adjourn the meeting, and I don't want to do that. I want to hear from you. I want everyone to hear from you. So what we'll do. If I don't have silence, I'm going to move to...
City Council Member Bruce Harrell did adjourn that meeting. Sydney, the police station is already on hold. What else do these protesters want?
Well, they actually have a list of demands on their website. And contrary to a lot of the news that's come out of this about protesters just wanting to shut down the police force, their demands are actually pretty nuanced. You know, they want bonds taken out to be given to social services, like to address homelessness and the drug epidemic. They are advocating for safe consumption sites. They want money to go towards low-income housing. They want council meetings to be held at a time that is more accessible. They want the Seattle Police Department Union, SPOG, to have less power than it currently holds. There's a whole list on here, and I'd invite anyone who's interested in actually engaging with what they're saying to engage them on policy. And not on style, because I think that's a digression.
Who's making that digression? Why do you bring that up?
I bring that up because a lot of the news I saw after Block the Bunker was about, was it appropriate for them to interrupt a public meeting in this way? And to that I would say that these are people... led by Black women and youth who have been traditionally kept out of the halls of public power. And the fact that they are engaging with public discourse right now in a city council meeting, which a lot of people just ignore, I think is a positive thing overall. And if we want to engage with them, we should engage with the substance of what they're saying.
CR, what's your reaction?
Well, I think they're going to probably... overstay their welcome here pretty quickly. I mean, listen, Bruce Harrell was saying, hey, we're going to allow public comment. So, you know, we will hear from you. And they almost didn't accept that. So it's going to get pretty unwelcoming at City Hall if their tactics continue, I think.
And this was not a subcommittee meeting just dedicated to this issue, right? This was a full city council meeting that got adjourned?
I'm not sure if it was a full council meeting or if it was a committee hearing meeting. But they typically do allow public comment at the openings of most meetings. Mm-hmm. So, and he was willing to do that there. I think you have to give them credit, though. I mean, they had a big win here. You know, they were very effectively mobilized to stop this North Precinct. They had great branding.
What do you mean great branding?
I think Block the Bunker is a great brand. You know, Bunker is what they were calling this North Precinct. It was overbuilt and too much and all for the police. You know, and they got aggressive and they got attention. But they did get lucky. I mean, there is a wind at their back here because council members have been frustrated over the over budget of a lot of big capital projects. The seawall is over budget by millions. This computer program is over budget by millions.
Which computer program?
Oh, there's a new computer program for billing at the utility department that's, what, $30, $40 million over the original budget. Now you have the North Precinct that's, you know, with double the original cost when this was first put out. So council members were in a mood to be skeptical about this North Precinct. But these folks put it in the front of the agenda. And, you know, I think you're not going to see a new precinct in the North End for a decade.
Really? Because City Council Member Shama Sawant seemed to be saying that the mayor is fully committed to this happening. She didn't say that this is, I don't think that this is just public relations, but we don't know yet until something actually happens how seriously what the city actually is doing with these protests, right?
Yeah, but I think it would be a bad PR move to say one thing and then do something else. And I think that city council and the mayor discovered pretty quickly that people are very focused on this issue, and their focus is not going to wane. There are going to be people following up and demanding that they do something.
The mayor says he's going to re-study the cost of the building and look at the racial implications of that.
Yeah, I mean,
project.
This building, you know, everything changed when the Seattle Times published pictures of this North Precinct, which was this gold-plated monument. It looked like the downtown public library, I mean, which is an architectural masterpiece, and that's appropriate for a building that's full of books and for the public, but not for a police precinct. It just was overkill, and it was over-designed. And it just had to go back to the drawing board. And the point of the protesters were, especially at a time when you've got money needs and you're under a DOJ consent decree to put more money into training and all these other things, you're spending $150 million on this huge precinct. It was just it was really tone deaf, and the pictures killed it.
Well, not everyone is speaking with the same voice. These are a bunch of individuals who agree on some things and not others. One of the demands I heard was that the city not hire 200 new police officers. Sydney police sometimes abuse their power, but they also keep people safe, including people of color and including poor people. What evidence do the organizers give that fewer police officers is better for the city?
Well, I think one of the things that was highlighted over and over and over again was the amount of distrust between communities of color and the police. And you don't have to look very far to understand why. I mean, there have been two police-involved shootings that have gripped national attention in just the last week, Keith Lamont Scott and Terrence Crutcher. And the videos are available for anyone to see. Danny Westneat wrote a column. I think this issue is incredibly nuanced. But Danny Westneat wrote a column
in the Seattle Times.
From the Seattle Times saying, you know, at a time like this, we shouldn't defund police because gun violence is on the rise and rapes are actually on the rise. And just to show how nuanced this issue is, I want to dive into his numbers a little bit, because he did some great reporting. He went to SPD and got numbers that reported rapes were on the rise. But he also mentioned that stranger danger rapes, as in rapes where someone jumps out of the bushes and attacks you and you don't know them, there are only 13 of them this year. He said that's good news. What we know from the research on rape is that stranger danger is actually a rape myth. The vast majority of rapes are committed by someone that you know, upwards of 80%. So the fact that the police reports are beginning to reflect reality may not be a sign of increased crime. It may be a sign of social progress, that people are actually beginning to report to police more often. So I think Danny Westneat and some people who would argue that we need more police would say that, well, police are still getting more case reports, so they need more resources to deal with those case reports. Here's the burden of responsibility. When you report to the police, you need them to take that report seriously. You need them to investigate it thoroughly, and you want it to go to a prosecutor's office, and you want that prosecutor's office to do everything in their power to secure a conviction. Often with victims of sexual assault, that doesn't happen. So I think there needs to be work done on both sides. Like, I think it's great that more people are reporting to the police, but we also need something from the police, too, to help us build up trust that has been destroyed and lost over time. And I think when we talk about defunding the police or giving the police more resources, it's always kind of like this chicken and egg game. You know, like, do the police need to show us that they're doing better first, or should we just trust the police? And I think the people who were speaking in that room in council chambers the other day had a lot of reason to show, hey, maybe we shouldn't. And, you know, in terms of police reform in Seattle, that's been very slow. We have to engage with what they're saying.
So finally, the most important thing you think will come out of these discussions, CR?
Well, I think they're going to have a harder time on this cutting back police officers. You know, the mayor's proposing 200 and they want none of those, you know, use the money for other things. That's going to be a trickier sell than trying to stop, you know, the bunker, stop the North Precinct. The fear or the desire to have more police, I'll put it that way, around the whole city is a lot stronger than the desire to keep the North Precinct. You know, you got communities all over town that are worried about crime. there's sort of, you know, arguments about statistics here and there. Property crime is up. We certainly know the police department hasn't grown in 40 years. We basically are between, you know, 1,200 and 1,300 cops like we had in the 70s. I mean, and the city has grown by 75%. So there's been a lot of talk over a lot of years, even started by Nick Licata not that many cycles ago, to increase the police force. So I think that's going to be a harder sell to try and stop the increase in police for this group.
We're going to talk about stopping a North Dakota pipeline. We're going to talk about robot cars taking over I-5 and more. Let's pause it there and come back in a moment on KOW's Week in Review. The Strangers, Sidney Brownstone, Q13, C.R. Douglas, and Bill Radke, we're with you learning from the news of the week. And this week, Seattle got a visit from a presidential candidate.
This is the craziest election ever. And it's crazy because I think I am going to be the next president of the United States. That's how crazy it is. Yeah, yeah.
Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson talking at a rally in Seattle on Saturday. CR, you told us that Gary Johnson's getting about 16% support in this state compared to 8% in other states. Why would he be getting double the support in Washington?
Well, we actually have a pretty strong libertarian streak in Washington state, an independent / libertarian streak. I mean, guys like Ron Paul have done well in this state. Rand Paul, I mean, this is a history that kind of he's tapping into.
Why do you think we have that independent streak?
It probably the fact that we're a Western state helps. And if you look at our third party, you know, the success of third party candidates here, it's pretty good. I mean, Perot in 1992, he got 24% of the vote in Washington, which is only, you know, he only got 19% nationally. So he did better here. So my guess is that's why he wanted to come here. There's also, you know, to sort of gin up even more support, there's two aims here. One is he's trying to get into the debates, and he isn't going to make the first one. They've already made that decision. You have to have this 15%, you know, threshold in public polls. Well, he's not going to make that. I don't think he'll even make that by the second and third debate. But what he's trying to do is goose his numbers in a number of states where he is at 15%, and Washington's one of them. So he can at least go to the debate commission and say, okay, I'm not in 15% in national polls, but I'm 15% in a ton of states. Isn't that worth something? So I think that's part of why he's coming to Washington.
Competing for the right to be mocked by Donald Trump on a debate stage. Sidney, you also think that Johnson is appealing to the technocrats we have in Washington.
Yeah, I mean, didn't he say that he wanted the future to be Uber everything?
Right.
And I think this comes from...
Will you explain that, by the way? What do you think he meant by that?
Well, I think he was kind of painting a different vision for the future that the other two candidates, Hillary and Donald, have not. And he's really appealing to this recent tradition of... saying that innovation can fix everything. You know, the problem with government is just that it's inefficient. And me, a white dude, will come in and make everything more efficient because I know the way. And I think that he's
trying... Is it about his white dudeness or a techno love?
Well, I think those two things overlap historically. But I think that preaching innovation and efficiency without engaging... the structural social problems of our society isn't going to take us anywhere. And in case it needs to be mentioned again, the guy did not know what Aleppo was. So, I've written him off.
Here's another surprise in this Washington election season. Republicans do not win statewide elections in this state. Or Oregon.
At least very often.
Or not very often. Or California. We're blue states. We elect Democrats. But in Washington, CR, there's one statewide office that always goes Republican. 50 years. The Secretary of State has been a Republican. First of all, can we tell listeners why that is?
Well, it's just been a blue state for a lot of years. So while you can win certain legislative districts as a Republican, it's really tough. It's really tough in statewide races. I mean, Puget Sound, King County just dominates.
But why has the Secretary of State been so Republican?
It is a position that voters here seem to like, the sort of moderate Republican, even by nonpartisan Republican in office. It just has this history of folks that aren't grinding an axe in one way or another. They're almost above politics. I mean, Sam Reed, the last one, was pretty much above politics. He had been an election administrator in Thurston County. Ralph Monroe before that was this, you know, avuncular, wonderful guy that I don't think, you know, offended anyone. I mean, it's been this kind of... He didn't see party. And it's been this, in a way, nonpartisan position. And people seem to like that. This person referees elections. And you want the person who's making those judgment calls in the hard cases. You know, should you count these ballots? Should you not count these ballots? You don't want them to have an axe to grind for one party or another.
Okay. So first of all, that situation, Republican Secretary of State for decades, why might that be about to change?
Well, a couple reasons. One is this is getting a lot of attention because the other races aren't. I mean, you don't have much attention or much less attention than typical to the governor's race. It's just not as strong a challenge against Inslee as people expected. You don't have a strong challenge and a well-funded challenge in the Senate race against Patty Murray. And you don't even have a challenge from Republicans in the attorney general race. So the big three races are just not what they typically are. So up comes Secretary of State, which is now getting all this attention. And out of nowhere, Tina Podlodowski, this Democrat, has said, I'm going to go for this in a way Democrats have never in the past, certainly not in my memory. And so she's well-funded. She's articulate. She has a background in politics. She's a fighter. So she is really giving Kim Wyman a run for her money. And she's being helped by the vacuum that's created because these other races aren't getting the attention.
Sydney, what is Tina Podlodowski's number one claim to the job of Secretary of State?
Well, I think her most innovative idea is that...
Gary Johnson.
Yeah.
She's really disrupting the whole election.
Yeah, I'm really, really disrupting in here. Mailing in your ballot should be free. And she's slamming Kim Wyman on the fact that Snohomish County now has to pay 68 cents to mail in their ballots.
Because it's bulky?
Yeah,
so it's extra postage.
Right. And added to that is in this crazy presidential election year, Kim Wyman has a Republican problem. Like, a lot of Republicans, especially in Washington State, are trying to run from any affiliation with Donald Trump. And Tina Podlodowski doesn't have to do much to point out that the Republican Party has historically been the party of voter suppression. And Kim Wyman has said that she would back any legislation to increase voter ID requirements. So Tina Podlodowski, she's basically running on a platform of trying to make voting more accessible. And when this type of election year comes up, it's a good time to do that.
Podlodowski says that under Kim Wyman's watch, voter turnout has declined. Is that a fair charge, CR?
It is fair. She stretches it a bit, but the general concept is fair. I mean, if you look at the general election last year in 2015, November 2015, turnout was 38.5%. That's the lowest in state history. I mean, basically, we've never had turnout that low. And if you look at the comparable elections since she's been in office, since 2012, and you look at their, you know, four different elections we have, you know, there's sort of a cycle of four, they all are sort of lower than when she first came into office. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, you could blame the election administrator, and that's what Tina's trying to do. But it also is a lot to do with what's on the ballot. And there were some big sort of races and issues that were on the ballot before Kim got elected. So if you sort of compare apples to apples, it's
and
not as
2012 fair. Was a presidential election year that got a lot of attention. So you would expect voter turnout to decline.
If you account for the different parts of the cycle, if you took the off-year elections, they're even lower than the off-year before she got elected. The other thing to say, however, is that voting is down nationally. So there is a larger trend in a voter turnout problem, if you will, that's not just in Washington. It's all over the country. It's probably has to do with this, you know, distrust of government and all the worry and everything. So if you actually look at the context, we do better. Yeah, voting's been down here, but it's not as down as it is in other states. So you could say, you know, in that respect, Kim Wyman's actually doing something good because we're not following the national trend as badly.
Tina Podlodowski wants postage-free ballots. We do mail in here. She wants 16- and 17-year-olds to be able to pre-register before they can actually vote. She wants same-day registration so you can register and vote on the same day, and automatic voter registration at driver's license time. What does Kim Wyman say about those proposals?
I think she's been – I don't think she supports – same-day voter registration. Actually, I might have to fact-check that. CR, do you?
Yeah, she doesn't support same-day voter registration. She does support automatic registration when you do your license, and she's actually pushed that, and it's the legislature that stopped that. But just quickly on her response, because I just interviewed them. I had a debate with them this week, so this is fresh in my mind. She says about same-day voter registration that it's tough for administrators on the same day to do it. It's a big burden. We have an 8-day advance registration, I think, as late as 8 days. But administratively, she says it's difficult to do that. So that's her argument against that. Postage-free balloting, I did ask her about that. I wouldn't say she's rabidly against it, but there's some complications with postage-free balloting. One is postage-free ballots don't have postmarks. And part of the problem here in Washington is that you
has
don't
to be
have
postmarked
to have
by election day.
By election day, you have to have it postmarked.
Yeah.
So if non-postage ballots don't get postmarked, how do you deal with that? So there's a little bit of a complication that would have to be worked through.
Okay, we'll pause there. I'm still wondering why it's a partisan office. The person who runs our elections, do we really want that to be a partisan?
There are a lot of people that say it should be a nonpartisan position, or should just be an appointed position.
Unless you have a party that makes it a value to suppress voter registration. So.
There you go.
The voter suppression efforts certainly have been associated with Republican parties in a lot of other states. It really hasn't been in this state. I mean, we don't have those voter ID pushes and all the other things that you have seen in other states.
We will be watching the Secretary of State election, Tim Wyman and T. Podlodowski. And now you know something about it that you can be thinking about as you head into Election Day. Bikes and cars with no one behind the wheel and profanity all seems to go together. That and more coming up on the Week in Review. We're live tweeting this show, as always, at KUOW. What show, you ask? Thank you for asking. It's the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Stranger environment reporter Sydney Brownstone and Q13 political analyst C.R. Douglas. Driverless vehicles are coming. And they will take over I-5 if some Seattle investors get their way. KUOW's John Ryan had the story.
The startling proposal comes from a venture capital firm that invests in high-tech startups. Tom Ahlberg is with the Madrona Venture Group.
You know, our proposal is not to ban humans at this point.
Well, that's reassuring. At first, the robot cars would just get to share the HOV lanes on I-5. Then the driverless cars would get their own lanes. Then they'd get all the lanes. Except for nights and weekends, when the humans could retake their former territory behind the wheel.
So it'd be phased in a little bit starting now, but phased in over the next 10, 15 years.
Companies from Ford to Google are rushing to develop robot cars or autonomous vehicles. Supposedly, the car's advanced sensors will soon be able to reduce accidents and traffic by driving better than humans can. That said, at least one person died this summer when letting their Tesla car do the driving. Ahlberg says the I-5 proposal is not for the timid, but a driverless I-5 would boost business and tourism between the two high-tech cities, and he says it's coming.
I do think that driverless cars and buses and trucks is inevitable.
Resistance may be futile in the eyes of technology promoters, but critics don't buy it. A University of Washington study this year said driverless cars could mean more traffic and more pollution as people choose to be riders in their own cars instead of in energy-efficient vehicles like buses or trains. In Seattle, I'm John Ryan, KUOW News.
Sydney Brownstone, we don't know the future, but what do we know about how realistic this is? All of I-5 driverless in 10 to 15 years?
I don't know, Bill. I mean, I used to work for a magazine called Fast Company, and I was a science and tech reporter, and a big part of my job was analyzing trends like these buzzwords that tend to pop up, driverless cars. And we know that there's a lot of venture capital pouring into these efforts. What I would ask is, to anyone interested in driverless cars, how is a car, so four wheels on a highway, more efficient than a bus or a train? It's still a car. Driverless cars are still cars.
Well, there will be driverless buses too, I assume.
Yeah, but just when you think about the efficiency in terms of space and resources, I don't see how driverless cars actually solve a problem. I see driverless cars as a solution to a non-existent problem at the moment. And I would beg people pouring venture capital money into this effort to pour their money instead to maybe building out our light rail system or pushing Sound Transit on the ballot this November.
How about you, CR?
Well, I'm a slight skeptic about how quickly they would be, you know, absorbed in the general public. But it's an intriguing idea. I think it's going to happen, meaning I think we're going this direction where these kind of cars are going to be on the road. I don't know that you have to do one thing to I-5, however. I mean, right now, their big argument, Tom Ahlberg, who you heard there, is that, you know, the great thing about driverless cars between Seattle and Vancouver is you recapture all this lost time. Like, if you're not in traffic or worried about driving, you can look at your emails and, you know, make cell phone calls and watch, you know, marathon episodes of Breaking Bad. I mean, all this kind of stuff you can do.
Daydream. Play with your kid.
Go to sleep.
Yeah.
But you don't have to do anything to I-5 to have that happen. Just drive your driverless car on I-5 and you can spend 2.5 hours or whatever, you know, watching movies. So I'm not sure you have to restripe the real estate, if you will, along the corridor. And especially, you know, the whole purpose of the HOV lane is to incentivize carpools. And if you start giving that space over to driverless cars, well, you're back to a lot of single occupancy vehicles in the HOV lane, which seems to me to you know.
Now we're bringing the HOV number down. 2+, 3+, how about 0?
Yeah,
Tom Ahlberg has not convinced me that driverless cars are a public good. So maybe you can have him on here and have him explain that.
Well, there is the I'm sure you've driven in an HOV lane when you can and just zipped along past a massive traffic jam. I have, and I thought, is carpooling so horrible? Do we hate one another so much that we'd rather sit there than be in the carpool lane? And apparently the answer is yes. So the driverless car is a private driverless pod where you don't have to be around other people. And whether we wish that were appealing or not, isn't that how a lot of people prefer to go?
As a society, we should just not be incentivizing single occupancy vehicles, period. With everything that we know about pollution and climate change, it's frankly irresponsible to incentivize that. How do we get people out of their single occupancy vehicles? We need to make the alternatives a lot better, which is why I keep hammering on mass transit. We have to develop real viable alternatives like light rail. We have to build that out. And also, disincentives are a part of the equation, too, like not acquiescing to every parking demand from people who are frustrating with parking. As a society, we have to move away from cars. To me, that's just obvious.
It's interesting because one of the things they say is that, hey, if you really want to do high-speed rail between Seattle and Vancouver, it's something like $30 billion. So, you know, isn't that crazy? Let's look at some alternative like this. And I think that's right. I mean, rail would be super expensive between Seattle and Vancouver. Now, we have Amtrak, and they're doing some improvements to the tracks, and they're trying to get that down from an average speed of 70 miles an hour to more like 100 miles an hour. So there'll be some improvements there. But, you know, I don't know that the top goal in the world needs to be getting to Seattle and Vancouver in 2 hours and 20 minutes. I mean, what's wrong with 3 hours and 20 minutes?
Well, you say that it's expensive, but what about the externalized costs of having all these congested cars on the road? Like, the externalized costs of car culture are health problems, they're problems with the environment, and that's something that we don't usually factor into these equations.
What about the electric vehicle, electricity made by Washington State rivers argument?
I mean, hydropower is better. It's not the best. It's not a totally renewable resource when we have dams on our rivers, but it's better than fossil fuel consumption.
I think one thing about driverless cars is they're going to be a lot of different things. There's going to be the fully automated, does everything for you, but then there's also going to be kind of, you know, this side of that. There'll be driverless cars that will brake if you are going into a lane and there's another car there. So you're sort of driving, but not completely driving. I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of different versions of driverless cars where some pieces of the drive is automated, but not all of it. I think one thing that's going to be a problem with driverless cars is everyone likes to speed. You know, you don't want to go between Seattle and Vancouver at 65 or even 70.
Right. Are they going to set that automated speed?
I think you're going to be stuck with a speed limit if you're in a
car
and not going to be that happy about it.
Let's continue to talk about wheels, because Seattle's trying to save its bike share program. You have no doubt seen the neon green bikes, mostly downtown and nearby. You pay for a bike, you get where you're going, you drop the bike off. But what if not enough people use the bikes, CR? You could shut it down, or you could make it bigger. Now it looks like the city's going to replace the bikes?
Well, and this is one of the biggest boondoggles in recent city history, city government history. And there's this big conundrum, which is why bike share works in so many other cities and has been an abysmal failure in Seattle. I mean, we're the poster child for how to do bike share completely wrong. And I don't think there's just one reason. I think it's been a perfect storm of kind of problems. I mean, the system wasn't big enough. They didn't have enough stations. They didn't have the stations in the right places. There weren't many.
Just tell me about that. Why would a bigger... That has been an argument that a bigger system works better. Why?
And I think this is the fundamental problem with our system. We have a helmet law that's a problem, and the bikes were too heavy and some kind of things. But if you get down to it, we only had, at rollout and continue to have, 50 stations and 500 bikes. And when you look at cities that have succeeded greatly with bike share, Washington, D.C., Boston, New York, Portland, they have several, you know, at least 100. I think Portland started out with 100. They have several hundred stations. They have a couple thousand bikes. I mean, it's the network effect. The idea is the density of station placement is what equals a successful system. When you have to go far between stations and when you don't know where they are and you have to look hard for them, people just don't get on the bikes. So we started, and we didn't even really start with a 50 station network. We started with a 40 station network downtown, and then a 10 station network here in the U District, which weren't really connected. So you almost had these two mini universes that weren't nearly big enough. And the whole idea behind bailing out Pronto earlier this year was, hey, let's take the system back. They're going under. And the idea is we're going to build this out, put a lot more stations out there, a lot more bikes, and hopefully look like other cities where this has succeeded.
So then why is that a boondoggle? You're saying, yeah, big it up.
Because it cost them millions to get to this point, and they're having to basically kind of start from scratch. If you look at Portland, which initiated bike share last year, they started with a $10 million grant from Nike. They started out with 1,000 bikes. They started out with 100 stations, and it just took off like that. Memberships were off the chart the first week. Bike share is so popular down there. They're keeping growing it. So we started small. We did it on the cheap. We didn't get enough.
Okay, so it wasn't a boondoggle to buy it and have a plan to expand it. It was a boondoggle to start it ridiculously small in the first place.
It was done poorly from the beginning and was mismanaged.
Sydney?
Yeah, I mean, I am nodding my head vigorously with CR over here. I think that making bike share into a public good that is used by everyone, you have to make it accessible to everyone. And that means investing public resources. Now, in this situation, I think we also have to look at funding sources, because Pronto was coming from an inconsistent source of funding. It was relying on private sponsorships, essentially. And when we look at D.C., the rollout of their program came from a federal grant. No one was relying on private sponsors to fill in the holes. And with that big federal grant, millions of dollars, I think they were able to do it in a much wider and more socially responsible way that really got more citizens of the city using bike share instead of just the tourists for rolling around downtown.
Yeah, and that's how it was mostly used in Seattle.
I think, you know, I'm in favor of sort of some sponsorship in this. I mean, there's some sponsorship opportunities. You might as well go for those. But if you look at Portland, they got $10 million initial sponsor from Nike. We got a $2.5 million initial sponsor from Alaska Airlines. So four times more in Portland just to help launch that system. And, you know, we did it in effect on the cheap. It was this weird hybrid between who's in charge, the city or bike share, and there were some management problems that let this thing flounder for several months, and they lost some time there. So it should succeed in Seattle. It probably eventually will succeed in Seattle, but they did everything wrong to start it.
The question is what to do now, and it looks like the city is favoring, according to the Seattle Times, is favoring this Canadian bike share company. So all new bike stations. So if you want to buy some bikes with bike stations, now this is an excellent, this is a buyer's opportunity because it's going to be a whole new system and it's going to be electricity assisted. Good idea?
I mean, if you buy into the argument that people weren't using bike share because Seattle has hills, it's a good idea. I'm not sure I buy that argument. I agree with CR that the problem was the scale. You know, it was that we implemented so small at the beginning that we couldn't reach kind of saturation of people using it. And again, I think we have to look at funding sources. I think that if we got an infusion of federal money that would kind of hold us to our social values in making this accessible for everyone, it could be better. But I don't know what's happening next.
Yeah, that is an open question. Will people ride them because they're electric? Because bike share is hard, right? So I'm willing to plan my route, my schedule, my backpack, my two sets of clothes, maybe my shower, but pedaling my feet. That's a deal breaker. Okay,
you can always get a solo wheel.
But it seems to work in so many other cities. So it shouldn't be that hard. They are looking at, and this is a kind of a subplot here. It is interesting that the company that asked them to bail them out, you know, you take over this program, you can do it. Well, they have come back within 3 months and said, well, actually, none of that works. And to really succeed, you'll have to do electric bikes. So kind of a pretty weird reversal from this bike share company. Now, I don't know that they'll go fully electric. I don't know that they need to. I mean, they're going to consider those bids and see whether that's the answer. We do have a bunch of hills here. But I think a third of the trips now are taken uphill anyway. So it doesn't seem to be the big barrier. It's more, I think, as we've been talking about, the station density, and it's not convenient. And for a while, none of these stations were even around light rail stops. You know, that's crazy. That's crazy.
Are we not as much of a bicycle city as we tell ourselves we are? You can blame weather and hills and all, that's fine. So bottom line, we're terrible for bicycles.
Well, I think our commute rate is like 3.5%. We're pretty good, actually. I mean, we actually have a pretty good commute bicycle rate.
But are those all the good people? Should we accept a ceiling? We already know all the good people are riding bikes.
You know, you hear a lot that it's the helmet law.
Yeah.
That, you know, we have one of the few cities where, you know, all adults, everyone has to wear a helmet. And that's a real disincentive to some. I mean, they don't want to check out the helmet. And it's complicated. If you didn't have to ride with a helmet, the theory goes you'd have, you know, one less barrier to jumping on these things.
And it could be bike share only, just not completely get rid of the helmet law, but it would be bike share is you have an exemption. You don't have to also rent the friggin' helmet on top of everything.
Yeah, I mean, be interesting if you could actually craft a law that way. And I believe it's a countywide law.
What you don't need a helmet to ride? Light rail. Just
yeah.
Putting it out there. You don't need a helmet to ride that.
I said friggin' a moment ago. We're going to address that problem and talk about this North Dakota friggin' pipeline, so stay tuned. We are going to pedal forward on KUOW's Week in Review. First, some KUOW Facebook reaction to driverless cars. Pammy says, enough. We've got too many cars as it is. Rick says, why not? At this point, Seattle city planners don't give a rip about traffic anyway, so let's just go all out stupid with it. Sean says he doesn't want driverless vehicles on the roads. Who reading this has not had a frustrating experience? Now imagine it's traveling at 70 miles an hour and you can't make it stop. Okay, he's talking about phones. Phones are frustrating enough. Now this thing is traveling 70 miles an hour. Autonomous vehicles in closed environments like quarries, shipyards, and Mars make perfect sense. But I don't want my kids counted among the acceptable statistics just so someone can get their pizza delivered by a robot. And finally, Trevor says the good folks at this venture capital firm may have been enjoying too much of Washington's newly legal weed. So generally not into the driverless car on KOW's Facebook page. This is Sydney Brownstone and C.R. Douglas, and I'm Bill Radke with you. Next, we want to know, what does a North Dakota oil pipeline have to do with Washington State? Because hundreds of people from Washington and thousands from across the country came to North Dakota to protest the building of a pipeline they say would damage sacred tribal sites and threaten the Missouri River, where the Standing Rock Sioux tribe gets its water. Sydney, you're the stranger sent you there? Why did your Seattle employer send you to North Dakota for this story?
Oh, man. Well, first of all, I still can't believe they did that. But I'm really glad they did, because what we're seeing is this national historic moment, at least 280 tribes coming to rural North Dakota. This is completely unprecedented. The last time tribes came together around this an issue was 140 years ago at the Battle of Greasy Grass, I believe. So the fact that all these tribes came together over this one issue is historic in itself, but it also has a lot of significance for Western Washington, where we are also dealing with resource exploitation battles and the build-out of fossil fuel infrastructure. You only have to look at the protests over crude oil trains, for instance, or the once proposed coal export terminal in Bellingham, which would have been the largest coal export terminal on the Salish Sea. In both of these instances, tribes have stepped up to the plate and said, actually, this violates our treaty rights, and we're going to block this. With crude oil trains, it's the Swinomish. They have filed a lawsuit against BNSF saying that the traffic of crude oil trains going through their territory violates a previously agreed upon treaty, and the Lummi Nation has been fighting this once proposed coal export terminal for years, and they effectively got it shut down. What a lot of people don't realize is that tribes are sovereign nations within our borders. So when they say that corporations are violating their treaty rights, they have a government-to-government relationship with the United States of America, which means that the Army Corps of Engineers can come in and just shut down whatever's happening. And what's been happening over the last 30 years especially is courts have been holding up tribes' treaty rights in kind of an unprecedented way. So we've seen the buildup of these legal battles, we've seen increased economic power, and we've seen social media and a younger generation that's grown up around Occupy and the Black Lives Matter movement kind of coalesce on the great northern plains of North Dakota and say, no, you know what? Some values are sacred. Water is life, or in Lakota, Miniwichoni.
These treaties have been in existence for a long time, so, and I understand the awareness now in social media, and so you have hundreds of tribes there. But legally, what has changed? Why would tribes have any more power to stop projects like these now than ever?
Well, unfortunately, over the last 500 years, we've seen time and time again treaties being violated. That's not a new thing, and it's not a new thing that indigenous peoples are always on the front lines of these resource exploitation battles. What is new this time is that the Obama administration has stepped in. The Standing Rock Sioux tribe filed a motion for a preliminary injunction wanting to halt this pipeline that had already been halfway built. And just so people get a sense of scale, this is a 1,172-mile-long proposed pipeline that would traverse four states and cross under the Missouri River. The Missouri River feeds into the Missouri River. It goes out the Louisiana Gulf. This is a major water source for not just the tribe's 8,000 members, but millions and millions of people downstream. They filed this preliminary injunction, and the judge threw it out. He said, no, that's not going to fly. Immediately after that happened, the Obama administration, including the Department of the Interior, the Army, and what's the other one that I'm missing? One other one. I'll look it up later. They stepped in and they said, we respect the judge's decision, but we are going to request that the Dakota Access Pipeline halt construction on Lake Oahe, which is an artificial reservoir on the Missouri River, and the 20 miles surrounding it, which is where a lot of these sacred sites are. So the fact that this gained enough national attention for the Obama administration to step in and then not only say that, but say going forward, we need to develop a new relationship with tribes where they are consulted, where we get their consent to do these types of projects, I mean, at least symbolically has significance. And then just 6 days ago, in the U.S. District Court of Appeals, a judge found that the tribe's motion for a preliminary injunction deserved another look. So construction has halted, both because of the courts and because of the Obama administration.
Okay, one more question on this. So the federal court rules in favor of the pipeline. The Obama administration goes the other way, but the Obama administration has 3 months left in office. So how do we know this is the most important thing that happened, is that this current administration sided with the tribes?
We've seen domestic oil production explode in recent years under the Obama administration. But I think that as every action has an equal and opposite reaction, right? So as we've seen the development of infrastructure, you know, from North Dakota to refineries throughout the country, we've also seen protest movements. And these often include your traditional white environmentalists. I think that the rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline kind of changed the national agenda. Hillary Clinton had to answer to that. And I think the Dakota Access Pipeline is a new era in not just environmental protests, but in terms of indigenous empowerment. I think this is a really interesting historical inversion that a people who have been screwed over for the last 500 years and historically oppressed, surviving cultural assimilation and massacres, are now taking actions that save the communities downstream and surrounding them. And these are white people, too. You know, in Bellingham, white environmentalists were thrilled when the coal export facility got shut down. Everyone downstream of the Missouri River from the Standing Rock Sioux tribe is going to owe that tribe a big one.
Finally, CR, the Seattle City Council sort of got involved in this, passing a resolution standing with the people who want to stop the pipeline. You didn't care for the city's statement on this?
No, I thought it was actually appropriate. I mean, there was a lot of local tribes, as Sydney talked about, that were engaged in this. And so I think it was justified as a local statement.
Okay.
We also are, you know, we are a big part of the sort of fossil fuel industry, as she mentioned also. I mean, we are where a lot of the coal and oil from that region comes via train, and it affects our local communities, and you've got coal export terminals and all kinds of fights about should coal trains go through Seattle, all the rest. So I think it was an appropriate resolution given that. But I will say that it is tricky for the city council to get involved in something that's three states away. And they have done things at times where they've gotten pushback for, hey, you're butting into affairs that just aren't relevant to the Seattle City Council. I remember covering this, kind of the most notable pushback they got to a resolution was in 2000 when kind of an environmental group of city council members decided and passed a resolution calling for the breach of four dams on the Snake River over in eastern Washington so that salmon could get through. They thought that was important. Well, there were even Seattle Democrats who said, city council, what are you doing? These are people, Frank Chopp, others down in Olympia, who said, you're ruining our relationship with eastern Washington. We're trying to build bridges here with this group, and you're acting all arrogant about you know what's best for their dam. So they got a lot of pushback. And Richard Conlon, who sponsored the resolution at the council, actually took four of his council members over to eastern Washington and apologized and said, hey, the resolution was wrong. We're sorry. So they have in the past weighed into resolutions and done things that they've gotten into some problems. So it is a little bit tricky. Every interest group wants the Seattle City Council to do something, and they got to make judgment calls about what resolutions are important, what issues they should weigh in with their power of social persuasion and what they shouldn't.
Okay, we have time for one more topic here. We've been talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline. And in the course of the show, I've noted we have said both friggin' and screwed over. And I bring this up because this week, Seattle app developer Susie Lee was describing how her dating app, Siren, helps users get to know each other.
We want a little bit of help to start a conversation with somebody. We don't want to be an but these sites kind of make us in a way.
We bleeped that word twice because we would have gotten in trouble for letting you hear the word even though you know what the word was. This is absurd, according to the author of a new book called What the F. Its author, cognitive scientist Benjamin Bergen, says no one's hurt by cussing. In fact, there are cultures that don't even recognize cussing. He was saying in Japan, you can't offend somebody with an expletive. Now, slurs are different, but that profanity doesn't have to be out of bounds. So first we asked KOW listeners if they have rules for swearing, and Charles tweeted, no swearing at work. Outside work, I can swear, never directly at a person, only at a situation not in front of kids. And Jennifer says no rules to swearing. They are just words. Swear words, that is. Hurtful speech is something quite different. And Sydney, you shared with us that your mom had a swearing rule when you were a kid.
Yeah, I come from a very loud and opinionated Jewish family of New Yorkers. And my parents would pretty much curse freely, and my sister and I did too. This kind of refined over time to the point where my mother would sometimes just let expletives fly in the car. And when my sister was maybe 5 or 6 years old, one day my mom, someone cut her off and she, you know, let loose something. And my sister said, "Mom, what are those words mean?" And my mom said, "Oh, honey, those are car words. It's okay if you say them in the car."
Mm-hmm.
And my sister went, "Oh, okay." This kind of backfired when my baby sister would get into other people's cars and then just curse wildly and report back to us, "What have you been teaching your kids?" So I think we broke it to her then that, you know, they're not just car words, that wider society also views them as inappropriate at all times.
That is beautiful. CR, any personal swear rules or admonitions?
I'm not a big swearer, and that was notable because the other day in the newsroom, I was very frustrated, and I got up and yelled the BS word, and the whole newsroom like cranked their necks and looked at me and said, "Wow, did he just say that?" They were not used to that coming out of my mouth. And I will say, you know, I think swear words, I think some words being off limits is all right. I mean, if we normalize every word, we sanitize the whole language, and then you want to have power to your punch sometimes in language. And some of those off-limits words, when used at the right moment, really pack a punch.
And they're just so important. Satisfying. So satisfying.
So wrong. Feels so good because it's so wrong. So glad to have you both with us. Sydney freaking Brownstone from the Stranger Environment
yeah.
Reporter and C.R. Douglas, who I now know it's shocking if he says BS. I find that endearing about you. Thanks for joining us. And thanks for weighing in on Facebook and on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke, and we'll be back, of course, next week with the Week in Review. Thanks, guys.